Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, and be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of a delusive self, liberating ourselves from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So welcome everyone. Before we begin with the Dharma talk and discussion, it's good to do a loving kindness meditation. The practice of mindfulness, the practice of concentration, the practice of calming the mind, kind of allows us to be more peaceful and more open and a little more spacious in our lives. But a correlation of that is very much how we relate to one another. Some people think of the practice of mindfulness such as mindfully drinking a cup of tea, mindfully walking, mindfully breathing, mindfully brushing the teeth, mindfully picking up the phone, which describes sort of actions that are very much imbued with presence, right? Very present to what one is doing. But our relationship to one another, while certainly the capacity to be present to one another allows us truly to see one another, it doesn't really give us direction in terms of how we are to relate to one another on an ongoing way. And going back to the time of the Buddha, the sort of operating principle of interpersonal relations, this means of everyone, is friendship. Interesting. Friendship. Because I think throughout history, Buddhism is 2,500 years old, but certainly not historically delineated or solely by that frame of time. When one is in relationship to another human being in friendship, there are qualities of caring. One cares about the well-being of that person. Right? One does not want one's friends to suffer. One simply always wants one's friends to be happy, to be free of suffering. If our friends have difficulty, we wish they would be relieved of them. And also, if we are good friends with them, we want to help. With good friends, we don't want to be sources of suffering to them. With good friends, we want to be sources of happiness to them. And usually good friends are sources of happiness to us. If we are always in conflict with our friends, usually that friendship will not last. Usually we call those enemies over time. But friends delineate people that we're happy to be with, that we care about. And there's that mutual respect. Also in friendship, there's a lot of understanding and forgiveness. Our friends may not all be saints. Actually, other people may see our friends as less than saintly. But we are very accepting of our friends. We're willing often to overlook a lot of their shortcomings. We are very understanding, and we can be patient with them, etc., etc. So I guess what I'm saying is I think the fact that the operating principle of relationship, going back to the Buddha's time, is the capacity of one to offer friendship. Now, where Buddhism sort of departs from what kind of ordinary people do it, is that usually our friends, our good friends, are of small number, right? And usually our enemies are of small number. And usually the greatest number are people that we are neutral or indifferent to. Without going all the reasons of of randomness and choice, etc., which kind of create friendships with some and not with others, Buddhism understands that there's a kind of a random nature to that, and that all of us, because many people who we are friends with now, we weren't friends with at some point. It's only when we got to know them that we became friends with them. And there are many people who we go back over the years, we realize we were friendly with before, and we're totally indifferent to them. We haven't even thought about them. So there is a sense that on an ongoing basis, friendship is fairly random and kind of based on just sort of what's happening. But what the Buddhist path asks of us is to offer friendship to everyone, which means to offer all those qualities that are involved in a good friendship, to involve that in the way we relate to everyone. And so we practice that. And again, there are lots of good reasons for it, but from a purely selfish point of view, it feels good. When one is in that mind state of offering all those qualities of friendship to another human being, it feels good. And we feel close to that other human being. And we're connected to that other human being. And so why only make that few in number? We miss a lot of opportunity since there are many, many people that we come in contact with. As well as by making certain people our enemies, we misunderstand that if we were friends with them, many of the things that we dislike about them we would probably be overlooking or understanding or working through if we call them friends. So in other words, let us practice together what this looks like. So close your eyes and begin with begin with people that you do love, that you do like a lot. Family, brothers, sisters, parents, children, dear friends. Bring these people to mind. See them. And as you see them, send them, usually just by seeing them, your heart feels warm and open. And as you look at them, say to them, may you be happy. And may you be free of sadness and suffering and difficulty. May your body be free of illness. May it always know health. And may all the difficulties and challenges of your life be removed. May you know goodness in all you do. And in this way, in your own way, send for those friendly good wishes to your friends and loved ones. next bring to mind the people who may be acquaintances of yours. These could be people in the neighborhood, people at work, the sort of people that you really don't have any closeness with, but you kind of know who they are. You're kind of a nodding acquaintance with. Bring to mind these acquaintances. And as you see them, say to them, may you be happy. And really look at them and mean it. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering, free of difficulty. May you be free of all the emotional afflictions of anger, sadness, and worry, and despair. And may all the hard, difficult aspects of your life be lifted from you, and may there be goodness, lightness in your life. And may your body be free of disease. May it be healthy. So again, and just like before, send these acquaintances. These qualities that you have of offering friendship, kindness, support. And next bring to mind people you're neutral to, which means these are people, well, it could be like people that you might have seen here tonight. They're people you don't know at all. People you're really indifferent to what's going on in their life. People in the car next to us, people who walk around in the store with us, people who wait on us. People like that, people you might just pass in the neighborhood and just be indifferent to them, but know them by face. But this time, bring to mind some of these people that we're neutral or indifferent to. And look at them, and then from your heart say, may you be happy. And kind of mean it. Want them to be happy. Want them to be free of suffering. And want them to be healthy in body and mind. Want them to be free of anger and fear and sadness and all difficulties, personal, interpersonal. Send these types of good wishes to these people that we are historically indifferent to. And finally, bring to mind people you may be in a difficult relationship with, people you may be angry at, people you may hate, dislike, for all types of reasons. But being aware that there are people who in the past you've disliked that you've come to like, and the people in the past who you've liked who you've come to dislike, you realize how changeable it all is. And instead, you look at this person who you dislike or in a negative, aversive relationship with, and you see them as a human being. And we drop the story. And we see them and we say, may you be happy. May you be free of suffering. May your mind be free of all the emotional afflictions. All heaviness be lifted from you. May you know goodness and purpose and meaning in your life and be healthy in body and mind. Like this, send good wishes to these people. And next, or finally, see yourself in front of you. A self among selves that you should want also to be happy and to be free of suffering. So as you look at yourself, you send yourself all those qualities of friendship, caring, support, nurturance. May I be happy. And again, say it like you mean it. May I be free of suffering. May I live a life that is conducive to the uprooting of suffering within me. May I live a life that cultivates the qualities of loving kindness, compassion, understanding. Within myself and for others. May I take good care of my body and not mistreat it in any way. And if there's anything else that one needs to say to oneself, perhaps in terms of supporting and nourishing things that you want to change or uphold. Perhaps you're going through a difficult time in some way and you need some sort of supportive, wise counsel from yourself. So please take a moment to do that. And then finally, kind of let go of the meditation and bring your awareness to your heart center. And see if your heart feels open. Maybe a little more open than before we began, a little more tender. And sort of feel what it's like to have that kind of open heart that is capable of offering loving kindness and friendship to everyone. And then finally, I would suggest just imagine what may occur if you brought this heart, this open heart, into your daily life, if you brought it home with you. And perhaps in various types of relationships you're involved in, you may see something change or shift. Or the way you went through your day and how you related to the people you encounter. Perhaps you might notice something changing or shifting. Sheila, could you invite the bell? So I invite you to make the practice of loving kindness a part of your everyday practice. It's a good practice. And it's the kind of practice that one can do as part of one's daily meditation on the cushion, but also a practice one can take with one throughout the day, remembering as one is going through one's day and encountering, again, people we like, people we dislike, and mostly people we're indifferent to, that in these encounters we have the capacity of relating differently. We have the capacity of seeing those that we encounter as friends. Actually, to see everyone as a friend, and then within the context of that, some are better friends than others, but at least everyone is a friend. And so one approaches everyone with that sense of openness and concern and interest, I think you may find beneficial. And also, especially if you find that you're caught up in some kind of a negative reactivity to some person, and you get angry or dislike or whatever, it's also at times like that good to do loving kindness meditation. That kind of balances things. Because when we do get angry, we get very cartoon-like. I mean, we see the other people as cartoons. In other words, very one-dimensional. All bad, if you notice that. And all of a sudden, the whole complexity of that human being and any traces of goodness, kindness that they've had in the past or may have in the future, and probably still 99% of them have in the present, other than whatever incident caused us to get angry, that's all gone. And we see again this very one-dimensional cartoon character that we believe is the source of suffering to us, and therefore we're angry at them. So again, the practice of loving kindness helps balance things and restore things to a proper perspective. So before we get back to our teaching from the precious sun, the Tibetan teacher Padma Karpo, the White Lotus, any questions that anyone has about the practice we do here tonight, a formal sitting practice or any practice about how to bring the practice into the situations of one's daily life? Always good to be in the presence of fully enlightened Buddhas. So we can just continue on here. So I believe we, again, I'm reading from this book, Mind at Ease, but this is a book about meditation, but it's in the appendix that it has this actually old text from called The Precious Sun, Padma Karpo's Spiritual Life. And Padma Karpo was somebody from, I mean, centuries ago, 16th century, something like that. And then I think last time we read the first two. Did we read the first two? Yeah. And let me just read them again for those, since it's been a couple of weeks. And I won't comment on them because we commented on the first two verses last time. The first one says, "This human body that you possess is not owned by you. It is borrowed. And you will not possess it for an indefinite period. While you have the opportunity to do something worthwhile, don't you think you should make good use of it? Please turn your mind within and reflect on this." The next one was, "Wholesome thoughts are only intermittent, like illuminations caused by lightning in the dark of a stormy night. On rare occasions that you momentarily come to your senses, don't you think you should put some effort into doing something about it? Please turn your mind within and reflect on this." So this is the third verse. "All conditioned things are impermanent and subject to change. If you take a closer look at conditioned phenomena, you'll find they have no enduring essence. Don't you think it's mistaken to be obsessed with notions of acquisition? Please turn your mind and reflect on this. Some of you are participating in, but in our larger community, we are having what's called an intensive now, dealing with just this subject matter of the nature of things. And this is kind of like core, core catechism, but the real catechism, core teaching of the Buddhist teaching. All things are conditioned, all things are impermanent, and therefore all things are subject to change, and that they have no enduring essence. These are often called the three marks of existence, which means that everything, according to the Buddha, is this way. Now, this is something not all that difficult to understand intellectually. It's not that hard to say it. But it has profound implications if one really gets it. That is why he says, don't you think it's a mistake to be obsessed with notions of acquisition? Now, again, you know, I was talking to somebody last week because, you know, some people along the way, many people along the way learn, oh, it's probably good to let go, right? And so as a kind of a coping, as kind of a psychological mechanism, when we grab onto things and we see we're holding on and causing ourselves suffering or causing somebody else suffering, we can kind of say to ourselves, I should let go, right? I should let go because holding on, just causing suffering to myself. Holding on, I'm not doing anything. Holding on, I'm just trying to control the situation. Holding on, just causing my suffering, and or to others. So we can kind of, in an intellectual way, see why it's important to letting go. But what is being presented here is kind of more generic and deeper than just that kind of a coping mechanism of learning to let go. It's sort of like when you understand the way things are, you understand how to relate to them and not to relate to them because you understand their nature, right? When you understand, let's say, the nature of ice cream, you don't leave it out, do you? Right? You keep it in the freezer. Because you understand it is the nature of ice cream that when it gets warm at room temperature, it melts. And most people do not find ice cream soup an object of attraction. So we understand, by understanding the nature of something, we know how to relate to it. Right? We understand the nature of let's say roses or bougainvillea, they have thorns, so we know how to relate to it. So what is the nature of all conditioned things? What are all conditioned things? In Buddhism, the word is dharma, small d. Those are things. Sort of everything is a thing. I mean, I'm a thing, you're a thing, everything in me is a thing, thoughts are things, feelings are things, memories are things, you know, there are, in other words, everything we see, you know, every object of the eyes, those are things, right? Every sound that the ear hears, those are things. Everything the mouth tastes, those are things. Every odor the nose smells, those are things, right? Every feeling in our body, those are things. And any thing that our mind can be aware of, like thoughts, feelings, perceptions or something, these are things. So anything, physical or mental, is a thing. Is that clear? Everything is a thing. or in Buddhism they're called dharmas, small d in Sanskrit, or we say spoons about phenomena. Just anything that with any of the senses of the mind that one can perceive as some kind of object, that's a thing. Okay. Now he says all things are conditioned, which means something, other things are conditioning these things to manifest, right? Things don't come out of nowhere, right? So this thing, we could say, was originally created by, a man and a woman coming together, right? A sperm and egg, right? DNA, genetic code, chromosomes, right? All those, you know, came together to create this thing, right? And in the course of, I'm going to be 66 soon, so in the course of 66 years, many, many, many other things have conditioned this body and this mind, right? We could say the same thing, you know, this didn't spring out of nowhere, right? The materials, the factory, the people involved, you know, that caused it to come into being, conditioned it to be the way it is. Is that clear? A tree, seed and water and all that. So nothing comes out of nothing, right? Or we could say everything, you know, comes from something else. Is that clear? Everything is conditioned by something else, you know, and there are many, 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 many conditions. So the whole idea that somehow each and everything is self-sufficient, right, totally independent, is totally the opposite of the way the Buddhists look at things, which is that everything is interconnected, right? Everything is interrelated. Nothing stands alone. Okay? So this is a kind of way to look at life. And we know right now, I mean, the whole thing with climate and ecology and the whole thing with, is all about what? But somehow this affects that. Right? And even though it may not be apparent that all the little things that we do as we drive our cars around and heat our cars and air condition our house and buy our, that somehow that is affecting the atmosphere, that is affecting climate, that is affecting flowers and trees and animals, that somehow this is all interconnected and everything is conditioned and everything else. Is that clear? So because everything is conditioned, right, and everything is made up of parts and things, it is what? It is impermanent because it's not solid, right? Everything is conditioned by lots of causes and conditions, so everything is in the process of changing. There's no central essence of anything. I mean, in a nutshell, this is kind of the world view at a very micro and macro level of everything. Everything is in flux. Everything is changing. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, coming and going. Every day, different. Every moment, different. Right? Everything is constantly changing. Right? How one feels day by day changes. Right? I mean, is this clear? And this is not like some kind of philosophical stance. When this idea is presented, it is presented as not colored by whatever one's philosophical or religious viewpoint is. That this can be readily seen by anybody who looks at phenomena will notice that they are conditioned, not solid, subject to impermanence, constantly changing. Right? So therefore, and this is his last point, don't you think it is mistaken to be obsessed with notions of acquisition? Because acquisition means what? Trying to grab onto. If everything is constantly changing, if nothing is solid, if everything is made up of parts, right? When we try to grab onto something, we are looking for what? We're looking for something to hold on to, which will be stable, which will be permanent, right? And if you think about anything, whether it's a person, whether it's a relationship, whether it's an idea, whether it's a job, whether it's a feeling, whether it's an object, a house, a car, fame, anything that we are grabbing onto or trying to get because we think it'll give us happiness, etc. Right? He said, don't you think you ought to look at this? Because what is the nature of all phenomena? There's nothing solid there. So if you are looking for happiness, if you're looking for meaning, if you're looking for some sense of solidity, obviously to look for it by acquiring, grabbing onto, clutching, attaching to phenomena is maybe not the way to go about it. Is maybe not the way to go about achieving happiness. Because those things, those objects, those persons, those mental achievements that one thinks will give one a sense of solidity. I mean, we are seeking permanence. We want to be happy. Right? We want to feel whole. We want to feel good, right? We want love. I mean, there's lots of things that we want, but we go about it in ways that don't give it to us. And we wonder why. And we often think it's because what? I've picked the wrong object. I got to find a different thing to acquire. That'll make me happy. That'll give me a sense of solidity. But what is being presented here is it cannot be found by grabbing on to phenomena, can it? You try to grab on to your youth and what happens? Slips away. You try to grab on to your mortality and somebody else's mortality. It slips away. You want things to be stable. You want things to be always the same. You want things to be constant. And yet what? Because there are so many variables in this life and with people. Right? You want in yourself, you'd like to have a calm, peaceful mind. And yet you find it's not something you can grab. It's not something you can force. Don't you think it is mistaken to be obsessed with notions of acquisition? Please turn your mind within and reflect on this. I think this is very important. This is very much been part of our tradition. And you'll see in every verse, he doesn't kind of like, he states it, and then he doesn't say, and accept this as truth or else. You know what I mean? Or at the end of each verse, he presents a kind of way of looking at things, and then he says, please turn your mind within and reflect on this. Please turn your mind. This is the last sentence in every verse. And I think that's very special about this tradition, which says, discover the truth for yourself. Right? And again, this goes back to the Buddha, especially in his dying days, his disciples had been for years, kind of, tell us more. and he'd say, I've given it all to you. You have to make it your own now. It's up to you. Right? And the Buddha also would say to his disciples, just because I'm the Buddha, because you love me and respect me, I'm your teacher, et cetera, don't take what I say as truth until you have tested it through your own experience. Right? So I think this is important. You know, this in Buddhism, it's, you know, hear the teachings, reflect on the teachings, practice the teachings. You know, and that second thing is very important. You know, you hear the teachings, like you hear the teachings tonight, you read teachings, reflect on it. Does it make sense to you? Does it accord with your own experience? Is this the way, when you step back and look at your life and the life of others, does these teachings, do these way of looking at things make sense to you? Right? And only then, you know, put them into practice. Right? If you skip over that one, your practice will never have any real juice to it. Right? Because you really haven't chewed on it enough that it really has meaning to you. Right? So, in other words, what he's saying here, you know, if you reflect deeply on just this, you know, and really just watch your mind, watch your life, watch phenomena, is it this way? Is everything conditioned? Isn't there anything that doesn't have causes that have created it? Isn't there anything that's solid and unchanging? If there isn't, then that's a wake-up call to each of us, especially if we're running around devoting our life to trying to find some permanence and stability in things. Again, things aren't just external things. Things are thoughts. Things are beliefs. Things are desires. I mean, anything. This is the next verse. The appearance of the phenomenal world is similar to your dream experiences. When unexamined, it may give some temporary pleasure to your deluded mind. If you analyze it, you will see there is no substance to be found in it. Don't you think you should use critical analysis to discover this? Please turn your mind and reflect on this. But again, those of you who are in the intensive know about this critical analysis. We're actually using as a text, the Wheel of Analytical Investigation, a text that trains one in meditation how to use one's analytical mind to really look deeply into the nature of one's own mental and physical phenomena. Now, what does this mean? The appearance of the phenomenal world is similar to your dream experiences. Life is a dream. What does that mean, life is a dream? Life is a dream. Well, what it really means is here, it's, again, if you think about a dream, when you're dreaming, it all seems very real, doesn't it? The situations in your dream seem real. The people in your dream seem real. Whatever drama in the dream seems very real. It all seems very solid and real, doesn't it? And because in dreams things still appear solid and real, interesting enough, we can have emotions in dreams, in our dreams. Right? We can be happy in dreams. We can be sad in dreams. We can be scared in dreams. We can be angry in dreams. So in that sense, dreams are, even though things are a little more bizarre than most of us lead our daily life in dreams, yet how it unfolds very much the way ordinary life unfolds. It seems real and solid. We're in it, and we see, we hear, we smell, we touch. We have full sensory awareness, and we have a full range of feelings. And things seem real, don't they? Until what? Until we wake up, right? And upon awakening, we, all of us, instantaneously realize what? It's a dream, which means what? It wasn't real. It wasn't real in what way? It wasn't solid. It wasn't permanent, right? Because when we're in the dream, it seemed very real, didn't it? But upon awakening, we realized it was just a dream, which means it was what? Kind of illusory, kind of effervescent. Right? It was there, but it really wasn't there, was it? And especially if you had a dream you were very involved in, when you wake up, you're kind of a little what? Disoriented. Right? Because it's almost like you're in some other reality where things seem very real and the drama seem very real, and all of a sudden it's gone and you're not quite back. You know, which is the real world? But you know, my friends, our life is like this. We are constantly creating, looking for permanence and solidity. We're running after things. If I get this, I'll be happy. I mean, we're constantly wanting things to be permanent and solid, and not seeing this illusory quality to experience. Right? For example, each of us think we have a past, don't we? Right? Everybody here think they have a past? Right? You think you have a past. I mean, right? But you know you have a past only because why? Because you have memory. In reality, you have no past. It's all gone. Like last night's dream. All we really have is what? This moment. This is it. This is where we're alive. You know. Every experience that we've had in the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years is dreamlike, isn't it? Because it's only preserved in memory and in photographs, which are like memories. And that's the way it is, isn't it? We still carry people who are dead around in our mind, don't we? And in our mind, they can seem still quite alive. But the truth is, what? They are no longer here, aren't they? We know that, don't we? When we have moments of clarity. The same thing with what we call our future. We plan for our future, we anticipate our future, we have expectations about our future, which could be our future how it's going to be tomorrow, or our future when we go on vacation, or our future how our life's going to turn out, or our future what retirement's going to look like, or our future when this happens to me or that happens, right? We all think we have a future. But that's just a dream. Something we made up in our heads. It's not real, is it? How could it be real? It hasn't happened. And yet we live as if our past and our future are solid. And we, for many people, it can be a burden. Their past can be a burden because it's always weighing them down, or it's always impinging upon them, or they're always acting today as if they have to act this way because this is who they were. They're not free to be totally alive and fresh in the present, because they're carrying this past. Many people the same thing, they're carrying this future. When unexamined, the phenomenal world may give some temporary pleasure to our deluded mind, right? So, I'm really looking forward, let's say, to what? To breakfast tomorrow morning. Right? I'm really looking forward. I'm going to have French toast, maple syrup, fresh fruit. And just thinking about that tonight, could give me pleasure. Good. Right? And then tomorrow comes. Then I eat the French toast. And I eat the fruit. And that also can give me what? Pleasure. But then it's over. Where did it go? Now I'm on the other side. What happened to my pleasure? It's gone. Now I'm in a state of what? Non-pleasure. Absence of pleasure. Or I could be in a state of fullness. Overeating. Non-pleasure. Right? So it doesn't mean that, you know, having an encounter with phenomena cannot give us temporary pleasure. But it goes just like that. As soon as the experience is over and we're left what? With the next moment, which is maybe a letdown. Many people live this way. Always seeking activities, phenomena, things to give them pleasure. But the truth is, these things can only give us pleasure in the moment and then they're gone. And then things become flat again, or boring again, or dull again, or uninteresting again, or non-pleasurable again. So then we're what? We're looking around for the next thing that we can acquire. Right? And so this is like endless for most people. All different varieties and variations and themes, you know. If you analyze, you will see there's no substance to be found, and you think you should try critical analysis to discover this. Please turn within. Again, what I'm suggesting and what's being suggested here in the text is using these ways of looking at our life, we should just examine to see whether they're true or not. Right? Because again, as human beings, we seek happiness, right? Or we seek not to live a life of dissatisfaction, of alienation, of emotional lability, or always up and down, and like that. I mean, that gets old for us after a time. You know, we seek a way to live that has the capacity of really giving us a happiness which is not dependent on always grasping at things. Because again, like this text suggests, that pleasure is short-lived. And of course, I didn't mention, the real problem. Not only is the pleasure we get short-lived, but what happens when it doesn't work out that way? Right? I mean, what happens, I was so looking forward to the pancakes, and when I ate them, I didn't like them. You know, they really weren't the way I remembered them, or not the way I wanted them to be, or they got burnt. You know what I mean? So we're always, there's always the possibility that things turn out the way we want, right? And we'll have a moment of happiness or pleasure, moments of happiness and pleasure. Good. But then there's always that problem, things may not work out the way we want, or our needs, we may get frustrated or something, and then we get disappointed and frustrated or sad or things like that. So again, these kinds of issues, I think, it's interesting to see that people were looking at these same things just like us for thousands of years. People were kind of looking at the way they were leading their life, what's called normal life of acquisition, and somehow going, maybe this is not all it's cracked up to be. And maybe there's another way to find happiness and joy and meaning and purpose and goodness etc. in life. So he says, please use critical analysis to discover this. So this is very important. Many people who take up meditation would like to shoot their mind or something, get rid of their mind because their thoughts are driving them crazy. But that's not really so. I mean, our mind is really a wonderful thing. It's very creative. Just step back and watch it. It's really quite wonderful the way it unfolds things, unless it's kind of on a tangent which is producing you know, unhappiness. But in its best sense, it's quite creative. But it also has this, you know, we do have a capacity for self-awareness, right? Which is wonderful. I mean, we do, each of us, have this capacity that we can step back from our life. Animals don't have this capacity, and a lot of human beings don't seem to be able to use it. But again, it is a capacity of the human mind, again, opposed to the animal mind, that we can step back from our situation and look at it objectively. Right? I mean, that's incredible, because that means we have the capacity to look at what's going on and to make changes. You know, that's a gift. You know, inanimate things don't have that. Animals don't have that. Minerals don't have that. Plants don't have that. Right? I mean, as far as we know, at least in this world of all these various forms of life, it's only human beings who have that capacity. So that is considered a wonderful gift. And so that's why he says here, you know, when he talks about critical analysis, step back. And look at life, look at phenomena, look at the way you're going about things, look at the way human beings go about things. Is, you know, are we creating goodness in our life? Do we create happiness in our life? Or do we, out of our ignorance of the way things are, create suffering in our life? Even though we want to create happiness, do we just go about it in a way that we constantly find ourselves back in a state of dissatisfaction? We want to feel connected. We do all these activities, and yet we continue to feel disconnected from others. Right? We want to feel at one, and yet we feel separate. Right? We want to be at peace, and yet our minds are always riled up. So it's important that we both understand and take cognizance of what is really the inspiration of my heart, right? But also, how am I actually going about it, and what am I actually creating? So as he says here, please turn your mind within again and reflect on this. I would imagine that many of you who come here are here because in one way or another you are reflecting on your life. Right? You're looking at your life and you're wondering, are there other things that I could bring into my life that may make it better? Or can I be involved in things in a different way than I have? And that's good. We should not be scared of being open. We shouldn't be scared of questioning. We should not be scared of looking deeply. And we should not be scared of learning to trust that we have the capacity of finding authentic answers to the deepest kind of personal existential type questions that gnaw at us or nag at us, sometimes from very close and sometimes far away. But it's, I mean, this has always been the path of people who have, I think, a true spirituality, right? That they question the normal way that people in society do things, because they're able to look and see that this is not producing all the, all the peace, justice, all the good things that a good society produces, then why isn't it producing it? Why, as individuals, if we're going about supposedly the way society says to be leading a life, why aren't we happy? Why aren't we filled with love for one another? And why don't we care for one another? If this is the natural outgrowth of a certain way of living. So we have to, we want to look deeply into this, because there must be a reason. Any questions about these are meaningful? Again, these are short little verses, but they have they're pregnant with meaning. So does anybody have any questions? Yes.
If we're not supposed to grasp and hold on to anything, and I do understand the notions of impermanence and non-duality, is it also a mistake to hold on to these notions?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, not holding on to anything, we could say, is you're pretty deep into it to get to that point, right? I mean, that's a Buddha. I mean, that's a master. That's somebody who's really very developed, that they, you know, don't hold on to anything, right? I think for most of us, we got to stop holding on to the things that are causing us suffering, right? You know, it's like, you know what I mean? Most of us, you know, there are bucking broncos we're holding on to. You know, I mean, there are some things we just got to get off of. Right? So I think for most people, it's understanding that the holding on, the attachment, you know, one of the biggest things we hold on to is what? The idea of self. Me. You know, people hold on to that. And that causes them lots of suffering. Besides a lot of other things. But ultimately, you know, again, the whole idea is mastery. So when you say is, well, yeah, I mean, people can take the Dharma and spirituality and make that another thing they grab onto. You know? But I would say in the hierarchy of acquisition, acquiring a spiritual practice is probably developmentally a good step. Okay. Because acquiring, grasping at, holding on to practices and teachings that, you know, have the capacity of transforming us in a positive way are probably worth grasping onto. Ultimately, once you get it, you don't need to hold on to it. Once you've mastered your trade, once you've mastered your instrument, once you've mastered your craft, you no longer are always consumed with technique. You've mastered it, right? So it is you, right? But up to that point, again, you may hold on. You may need to hold on to it. In Buddhism, there's that saying, the raft is not the shore, right? The raft meaning. The Buddha, it's interesting. I mean, some religions say, you got to hold on to us forever. But Buddhism says that the teachings are just a raft. And the raft is not the shore. The shore is what? Freedom. The shore is liberation. The shore is awakening. That's where we want to get to. All the teachings and the practice of meditation are just the raft to get us there. Once you get us there, you know what I'm saying? I mean, like if you row the boat across, when you get to the shore, you don't put the rowboat on your back and carry it around, right? You don't need it anymore, right? You walk around, enjoy the land. So it's like that. But when you're on this bank and you want to get across, you need a boat. The teachings are the raft. You know, there's something that we have to acquire. to get us ashore. But remember, and this is a very important thing, everything we've read so far tells us it is not that phenomena is bad. Things aren't bad. You know, the things that give our senses pleasure aren't bad, right? People aren't bad. Relationships aren't bad, right? Having a house is not bad. Having a career and working your way up in your career is not bad. That's not the problem. The problem is what? Attachment. The problem is we see these things as permanent and solid, and so therefore we are so obsessed about getting them, and when we get them, we're happy. If we don't get them, we're unhappy. And after we get them, the pleasure only lasts so long before we're looking for the next level to go up, right? So the problem is not things. We want to understand the nature of phenomena so we won't attach to it. Is that clear? That's very important, because some people think, so therefore everything is bad, ice cream bad. No, attachment bad. Pancakes aren't bad. But why do you have to obsess about them? Right? And if they're good, they're good. And if they're burnt, you throw them out. Right? Have your Wheaties. What's the big deal, right? Well, because we're not attached. We're free. We can enjoy, and if it doesn't work out, we can do something else. Right? Is that? Any other questions?
I don't know if this has any connection when we're talking about impermanence and really the emptiness of things that have been and whose dependence. Well, many individuals are looking at back in time and such. Would you say that human beings, in the face of doing precisely what you're talking about and getting those results, somewhere along the line they created the notion or the conception of religion and God to counteract precisely what you're talking about, very much existential and part of the human condition, and it's believed by those that are, let's say, more mystical, more spiritually inclined via Orthodox religion, that they seek to escape all these things through communion or transcendence with God.
I'll let you say what you just said. In other words, I'm not going to get into God or because again, that's a whole, it's interesting. The Buddha himself, coming out of the Vedic tradition, in which there was God or gods, never denied the existence of gods or affirmed it. Because that wasn't really material to him. What material to him was that people clearly see the cause of their suffering, and he taught a path of personal liberation. Obviously, religion deals with many of the same things looking at the same conditions that the Buddha looked at, and the same type of suffering that people get in their lives. More of a theological or religious credo kind of faith-based gives a different response, let's say, than the Buddhist tradition, which is really about individual, personal, psychological, personal, transcendental, whatever you want to say it, transformation. But they're all looking at the same thing and coming up with different solutions. In a certain way, the path that the Buddha unfolded, which is a path of personal transformation and personal responsibility, is really not for everyone. It may be that it's not for most, because it's interesting even though the Buddha clearly did not teach a theology. If you go to Asia, you will see that in Asian Buddhism, you'll see that the Buddha is like a god. So it's interesting how things developed over 2,500 years. I mean, at the same time within the Buddhist tradition, especially within the meditative tradition, you know, the heart of the Buddhist teaching has been accurately preserved. But yet, on the kind of social level, you know what you see in Buddhist temples, whatever, it's very much like what you see in Western religion. So it's interesting that's what's happened. Any other questions? Yes. What?
Thanks for your teaching.
Oh.
cherishing others. And how I was reading a really interesting book which was along the line of these teachings. And if the way out of suffering is cherishing others,
yes,
even though they are in part of it,
mm-hmm,
I still want to cherish them a lot. But there's different ways of cherishing. For me, instance, I'm not sure how to cherish people other than if I go out and say, I'm going to fix your car because I cherish you, I'm not a good mechanic. But if I say, I'm a decent soccer coach, if I say, okay, give me your child, I'll teach him how to play soccer, I would be more valuable in cherishing people that way. Is people have a vocation, and does that cling in to charity?
Yeah, I mean, please. Whatever teaching you read, always combine it with common sense, right? And I think that's what you're saying. Right. I mean, you know, to have the desire to be of benefit to others, right? Still has to be kind of, it filters through each of us as individuals. And like you say, we all have our individual capacities, we all have our different situations in life, drama of our lives. And so therefore the opportunities will present itself very differently. And as you say, you know, trying to help somewhere where we don't have the capacity of helping may not help. So, right, yeah. Just because we'd like that person to have a working car, that doesn't mean us volunteering to work on it if we don't know what we're doing would be of help to them. And that example could be taken in many different ways. Obviously, to offer help to people in all kinds of ways when we really don't have the capacity, because we don't have the skill ourselves, would probably, you know, make the waters muddier or make the suffering greater. I mean, the one thing we always have to offer any of a human being is what? Support.
Right? A warm heart.
You know. You're not alone. You know? Yeah, I'll wait with you. I can't fix your car, but I'll stay here until the AAA shows up, because I can see you're kind of bent out of shape by what just happened, or scared, or, you know what I'm saying? So I think there is the capacity of offering support, kindness, counsel, you know, of a simple way. It's something that we can offer people, and if we have the capacity, more specifically in certain kind of skills or whether soccer skills or whether human skills to help another human being. I mean, that's good too. But, you know, we don't want to be grandiose in this, loving all sentient beings things. I think it's like we should just do it individual by individual. Right? Like just, you know, as we go through our day, we're often not aware how many people we do come in contact with. Okay? And there are more opportunities for connection that often happen right before us. Right? It's always amazing, you know, even if somebody's like in Publix or something or waiting on you, to really say to somebody, you know, how are you? You know, how is your day going? How is everything? To a complete stranger. You know, it's interesting. Connection, it's not that hard to make connection. And I think if you're sincere, people will feel that. You know, And it's quite possible to kind of befriend strangers. And they appear in our life much more than we think it, than we think they do. If we are aware, and if we are present to what's in front of us, which are often human beings just like ourselves. We're often so consumed with our own stories, or we're so focused on getting things done that we don't notice that there's a human being also right here who may be going through something. And that we often, if we stop, we can see it. We can see it in them, that something's going on. And we can ask a question that lets them know, maybe things are difficult. Anyhow, we should stop. Thank you all.
Yeah.